I'm here talking today with Mark Baldin, principal trumpet of the Rockford Symphony. Mark, how long have you been playing?
Well, I started playing in fourth grade, so that would have put me about 9-10 years old. Do the math, probably about 46, 47 years now.
All right. Why did you start playing trumpet? Was it just something that you were offered to you, or was offered to you in school?
Well, when growing up, my parents were both, particularly my father, both my parents were music lovers, jazz, classical. My father particularly had very wide-ranging tastes, so I used to tell people that his Janis Joplin records were next to the Gregorian chant. And actually, that's true. He had both, and he enjoyed both. So I always had music growing up, even though I didn't like it all the time. I went to sleep with a transistor radio in my head listening to whatever was popular in the mid-60s. But in fourth grade, my particular music program offered, or the school offered, lessons and that. And I went to the concert that the junior high put on to demonstrate the instruments. And Dad took me there and he said, "What do you want to play?" And I pointed to the trumpet. Now, I'd always been a big fan of Herb Alpert and the Tijuana Brass growing up, so that was part of it. And my dad, being a big jazz fan, he always had Louis Armstrong, Big Spiderbeck, and the like playing at home. So that just seemed like fun.
So when did you figure out that this is something you wanted to do for a career?
When I figured out I was not smart enough to be a chemist, actually. My first career goal as a child was to be a mad scientist and create all kinds of monsters. And then I found that I was no child prodigy by any extent, but I had a certain aptitude to the trumpet. I was good. I wasn't great, but I was good. And I enjoyed it a lot. And my sophomore year, the summer between my freshman and sophomore years in high school, I went down to a music camp at University of Illinois and had a fantastic time and learned a lot. And the 4 to 6 hours a day of playing that you did at that camp just pretty much put a booster rocket on my playing. And I came back playing better and I enjoyed it more and hopped about 9 people in terms of the first audition in band the next year. And I just started enjoying it more and more and more and started listening to more different kinds of music. I was more than a bit of a nerd in high school. I missed the entire late 70s, early 80s, well, actually mid 70s in terms of popular music. I was listening to nothing but jazz. There are those that would say I didn't miss much, but listened to classical jazz. But then about my sophomore year in high school, I started thinking about it and started practicing more and ended up deciding to go to music school.
Well, certainly, there's no doubt that the better you play, the more fun it is.
It is. It is. The times I have the hardest time making myself practice is when things aren't going well.
Which is, of course, when you have to.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
A bit more time.
Exactly.
Was there a particular trumpeter that you wanted to emulate, particularly when you got to college, when you really started to be serious about it? Was there somebody that you wanted to play like more than anybody else?
That's the problem, is that there were several that I wanted to play like. And the different kinds are kind of mutually exclusive in a way. You know, growing up in Chicago and being in the Chicago area and being a classical music nut, you got to think Adolf Herseth of the Chicago Symphony. But I also grew up listening to Maurice André recordings, and I grew up listening to Maynard Ferguson.
There's a whole lot of difference between Maurice André and Adolf Herseth.
Huge. And then throw in Maynard Ferguson and Harry James and, you know, Dizzy Gillespie and, oh gosh, I mean, there's so many different ones that each day I wanted to play like. When I got in high school, I thought I was a jazzer. I wanted to be a lead player. I still want to be a lead player. But I wanted to be thought I was a jazz player and got to college and met up with some real jazz trumpet players. And, no, Mark, you're a classical player. You're not a jazz player.
So what do you mean by that?
Well, I didn't have the facility in improvisation that I needed. Partly because I didn't practice the type of things the other people were. I didn't really realize what it took, what kind of... And that's something I still don't have in my own playing. I wish I was a better improviser than I am. I like trying, but, you know, I just don't have that kind of facility. And classical music was also a big love, so it wasn't like I was denying myself something.
Yeah.
It's you can express yourself in many different ways. And being at Northern Illinois University, particularly at the time I was there, you could do many different things. You could be in the jazz band and play in the symphony orchestra and play in the concert band, brass quintets, early music ensembles. That was available and encouraged. So you could do a lot of different things there.
Right.
And that was a wonderful education, not only just in the classical playing, but you started to see, at least to me, how the various disciplines could aid each other.
Yeah.
I remember reading an interview with Adolf Herseth, and when he was in the Army, he played lead in a big band. And he talked about how the experience of playing lead in a big band really helped in a lot of ways his ability to lead a brass section in the Chicago Symphony. And I found the same thing. There are things from each discipline that cross over quite a bit and help make you a little better in each.
Yeah, like, can you be specific? Can you give a couple examples?
Well, in big band playing, at least to my ears, when you're playing lead, timing is essential. Time, you don't really have a conductor.
Right.
So your time has to be taken from the drummer, the bass player. You have to be listening. You have to be really aware of what's going on. You also, I think, have to be very aware of silence. And you have to understand that silence in music is just as important as sound. And the rests are just as important as the notes, and they have to be respected. And how you end a note, or you could look at it, how you start the silence, has just as much of a rhythmic and percussive effect as the start of sound. And I think, although it's equally important in classical music, I don't think it's thought of in the same way.
Mm-hmm.
And in big band, how you end a note sets up the next event. And that makes a difference in classical playing, because that can make a difference between something that sounds very exciting, very rhythmically together, if you will, and something that's just, yeah, that was good, you know, that was okay. I've always thought the difference between a good group and a great group is not if they can start together. Because any bunch of people can start together, watch where the downbeat is. Do you end together? That's the real hallmark, because that means you have to be listening, you have to come to a decision on how the phrase should go, and you all have to be there at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
That's when things get rhythmically very exciting.
Yeah, that's so true, because so in terms of music notation, the beginning of the note is always very clear as to where it's supposed to start. But how long do you hold the note?
Exactly. And how do you end the note? Do you cut it off sharply? Do you let it taper a little bit? Do you let it taper a lot?
Yeah.
Do you have leeway in this particular piece, in this particular style, to be a little bit, you know, have a little bit of control when you start the rest? Or does it have to be really right there?
Right.
And all that is the difference between, I think, good performances and great performances.
Yeah. You have, I think everybody would agree that, who has heard you play, that you have a very big sound.
I try.
So I think very, it sounds very Chicago school to me.
Well, thank you. That's the sound in my head in a lot of ways. I mean, leavened with other sounds. I mean, our particular voice is always something that we synthesize from other things.
Mm-hmm.
Some teachers make a big deal of, you know, don't copy, don't imitate. I use the words imitate and copy differently with my students. I think you need to imitate, but you don't copy.
Mm-hmm.
To me, copying is trying to sound exactly like someone, which you can't really do all that well. But imitating, that's, to me, my definition is that's taking qualities you like in a certain player or a certain sound and trying to adapt them into your own voice.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we learn to talk by listening.
Right.
So very often, if you happen to hear my father, who passed away a number of years ago, but if you heard him talk, you would know exactly where I talk, where I get it from.
Yeah.
We learn through listening and then synthesizing our own voice from the various qualities. So obviously, my teachers all were in the Chicago area, and were very much steeped in that. Stu Lichty, to begin with, as my private teachers, and then Betty Eilers, who was a huge influence, and Ron Modell at Northern Illinois University, and a little bit of, but very, very important to my playing studies with Arnold Jacobs of the CSO. So I kind of had that sound, not only listening to it, but also my teachers were kind of
right
in that vein. As a matter of fact, Stu and Betty were both students of Arnold Jacobs when they were coming up.
Mm-hmm.
So I kind of had that going on. But also, there's a little Harry James, even in my classical playing,
mm-hmm.
if it's appropriate.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a little bit of Armando Gatala in places.
Mm-hmm.
In the Baroque literature, I hope there's a little bit of Maurice André in there when it's necessary. But it's, I hope, my own voice. But it's a synthesis.
Right.
Of everything I've heard, of all styles that I've heard.
Now, you're a big guy. How tall are you?
6'3".
6'3". Okay. Now, somebody might look at you and hear you play the trumpet and say, "Okay, I see the connection." In order to play the trumpet well and to produce that kind of a sound, you have to be a big person.
Absolutely untrue.
Right.
Absolutely untrue.
So, what does it take to play the trumpet?
This is going to sound flip, and it's not. I'm still figuring that out. I'm still figuring it out because
well,
every
I'm talking
time,
about you don't take somebody who's 4'11" and weighs 105 pounds and say you're going to play the tuba.
Well, if they can fit there, you know, they can. It's a matter of getting the lips to vibrate. It's a matter mm-hmm. of getting an efficient vibration. And there's all kinds of different ideas on how to do that. And you look at any 10 different players, you're going to see 10 different formations of the lip. You're going to see 10 different sizes of lung capacity. You're going to see 10 different physical strengths in these
yeah.
people. You look at someone, well, just off the top of my head, there's an incredible lead player in one of the military bands. I can't remember which one now because he's been in a couple of them. I think he's been in for 17 years, a lady by the name of Liesl Whitaker, who is not a large, you know, she's not small, but she'll take your head off with double C's. I mean, she's just incredible. Turn around, there was another fellow in England who's passed away, John Wilbraham, who was called Jumbo, was his nickname. He was a large man, but could play as delicately or as small, if necessary, as anybody. Mm-hmm. It's in control of the air. It isn't even in capacity. They say you have to have big lungs to play. No, you don't need to play with big lungs. You just need to be able to move the air.
Mm-hmm.
The only difference with someone with a larger lung capacity and a smaller lung capacity is the smaller lung capacity has to take more breaths.
Right.
That's it. That's the only thing. A former principal trumpet of the St. Louis Symphony, Susan Slaughter.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I always thought it was a wonderful name for a trumpet player.
Yes.
But she was principal in St. Louis for 30-some years, and she's a woman of rather short stature.
Mm-hmm.
Don't stand in front of her if she's mad at you.
Yeah.
Because what a sound she has. Just amazing. It's not size. As a matter of fact, you want trumpet playing, you want brass playing in general, to be as easy as possible.
Mm-hmm.
You want it to be as efficient as possible. So it's a combination of air, lip tension, tongue position, and again, any 10 different trumpet players will give you 10 different specific ideas.
Right.
So it's a lot of, I think a lot of it is imitating the sound you want.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a big believer in You want to train your embouchure, you want to train your lips. Imitate the sound that you're trying to make, and over time, your body will figure out how to make that sound.
When you're playing in an orchestra, as principal trumpet player, what are you alert for? When the rehearsal starts, when the performance starts, what are your ears looking for, and your eyes, and how do you see your role as the principal?
Well, again, I could say, you know, there's two sides to every trumpet player's personality. One is the side that wishes to do nothing more than lay waste to all that is in front of it and to leave the rose ahead of him in a pile of the dead and the dying. Then there's the dark side. But the reality is, like every other instrument in the orchestra, you have a different function depending on what the composer wants. Mm-hmm. The trumpet grew up, if you will, as a signal instrument. You know, it came from the conch shell or the bugle, and it was used to signal either battle or retreat. Or the bugle, the army bugle, was used to give instructions across a battlefield before there was any other kind of way of letting a lot of people have an instruction. And if you look at the Army Bugling Manual, particularly from the 1800s, early 1900s, mm-hmm. there was a bugle call for everything.
Yeah.
Bugle call for the males here, bugle call for turn left, turn right, a bugle call that meant get on your horses in the cavalry could mean, you know, get out and clean the deck in the Navy.
Yeah.
So you had to know lots of different calls. So depending on when the piece was written, the trumpet part is more of, basically, it's a bugle. It's there to signal excitement. It's there to signal danger. It's there to provide volume. Mm-hmm. You know, sometimes we're just there to make it louder.
Yeah.
Beethoven, Mozart, well, in Beethoven's time, you know, the trumpet was starting to be used a little bit differently. But, and not talking about the Baroque era, which is kind of a different use. Up until the valve was invented, a lot of what we did was just to signal, the help is on the way, the hero's coming. Mm-hmm. We're basically a percussion instrument very much in Mozart.
Yeah, and the timpani together, always.
Always. Mm-hmm. So we're kind of basically adding another voice to the percussion section. Mm-hmm. You get into Brahms, Schumann, Schubert, Beethoven, then we're getting a little bit more of a melodic point and used more, because I think they were looking for more volume, so there's more trumpet parts. Mm-hmm. A big mistake I used to make when I was coming up was thinking, oh, Beethoven, that's easy, you don't have to play in Beethoven. And then you play Beethoven 5 and you're toast by the end of the rehearsal because you play a lot in Beethoven 5 and 7 and 9. The valve gets invented around 1825, and now we can play chromatics. And I'm simplifying it because it came up through the cornet. But anyways, now we can play all the different half steps. And so composers started using the trumpet more melodically and giving us more and more things to do. But in terms of any particular piece, the trumpet's function depends on what you interpret the composer wanted. Does he want the trumpet to underscore something? Does he just want the trumpet to add a color to a background? Does they want the trumpet to lead the orchestra, which occasionally it does? We like to think we do it all the time, but we don't. Is it there to provide a percussion effect? That's all some of the decisions you have to make, and that depends, to me, on the piece, your knowledge of the era. A lot of people are very big on looking at the score and studying the score when they're learning a part. To be honest, I don't do that as much as I probably should, but I pay a lot of attention during rehearsals to see what's going on, and occasionally actually do what you asked me to do in terms of not playing so loudly or playing louder. And he is a most enlightened conductor, so we do get the chance to play louder every now and again. But So it all depends on the piece. It all depends on and the interpretation. What your particular concept is, or any conductor's particular concept. You listen to different recordings, and you can hear every instrument used quite differently, depending.
Yeah. I always hate getting this question asked of me, but I'll ask you anyway. What's your favorite? Who's your favorite composer in terms of orchestral trumpet playing?
That's. I hate it too because there's several.
Yeah.
There's several because as a trumpet player, you have to say Mahler, Strauss, Bruckner, this. But the truth is, they're great parts.
Yeah.
And the trumpet really gets a chance to demonstrate the wide variety that it can do.
Yeah.
I mean, with Mahler 5, which we did a few years ago, the trumpet players kind of think of the first movement, particularly of Mahler 5, as Mahler's trumpet concerto. But we also have to admit the horn is equally important in that. The solo horn is equally important in that. But just in the first movement, the trumpet is called upon to be kind of lead a funeral procession, lead a blazing brass choir, then turn around and play meltingly lyrical solos, and then turn around and basically portray a certain amount of madness in someone's, in the protagonist's psyche, if you will. Other pieces, the trumpet is more, how do I put it, not abstract, but is there more to project a mood as opposed to something a little bit more programmatic, you know? Musicologists and I disagree. I don't believe in abstract music, because music that doesn't have some kind of emotional content has no interest for me, and I don't play it well. Now, I'm not saying that everything has to depict particular events the way Strauss liked to in his tone poems, but to me, the music has to tell some kind of story, whether it's, and sometimes I construct stories in my head of what this means. And it may have absolutely nothing to do with what the composer wanted. But I really feel that if the performer doesn't have a story to tell, then the audience will not have a story to hear. Now, the audience might get a completely different story out of what I'm playing. But if I don't have a story, they don't get anything. So a favorite composer is sometimes depends on my mood. Sometimes it's whatever's in front of me at the moment. I mean, we're doing Mahler, the Mahler first. It's one of my favorites. And then you have Mahler second. And then you get Mahler 3. And then, I can't remember what composer was asked, what's your favorite Bruckner symphony? He said, the one I'm conducting right now.
Yeah, that's true. Now, it's anybody who's, a lot of people play trumpet when they're growing up. They start in, just like you, they started in grade school. They might play through high school. They might even play in college. And I think the majority of people think, well, there is, the trumpet is one instrument. You own several instruments. So why do you have, what are the purposes of each one of those trumpets?
A lot depends on the type of music you're playing. If you do mostly jazz, you do mostly commercial music, then the standard B-flat trumpet is what you're going to be playing the vast majority of the time.
That's the one everybody's familiar with.
That's the one everyone that you start with. Then you'll also probably play a flugelhorn, which is the instrument Chuck Mangione made famous, among other people. It's basically, the flugelhorn came out of the bugle, and it has a much larger bell. It has a much more woolly, warm sound, very ballad-like. So jazz players, basically those two are it. That's all you really need. With classical music, symphonic music, the different styles of music, the different tone qualities that are appropriate are sometimes easier to produce on trumpets of different pitch. So
the standard trumpet for classical musicians, classical players, is the C trumpet.
The C trumpet, which is pitched one whole step higher than the B flat, so it's a little bit shorter. Tone quality can sound pretty much the same as a B flat. It can be a little bit brighter. The history of what trumpet is used in orchestras, always ends up being more complicated than I thought. Every time I think I figured it out, that this was used here, this was used here, this was used here, I see, no, that isn't true. But the sea trumpet was popularized initially by the French. The French gravitated towards the lighter, brighter sound of the sea trumpet, particularly the older trumpets. The Germans, the Eastern Europeans, the English, they tended to the B-flat, the B-flat trumpet, particularly with the English with their great history of cornet players, and the Russians. So for a long time, all the German orchestras and the English orchestras played B-flats, the French orchestras played C-trumpets. And particularly in, 70, 80 years ago, that was one of the reasons the brass section sounded so vastly different. Mm-hmm. They were very different instruments. The British still use B-flats quite a bit. And the Germans, the orchestras still tend to gravitate to the B-flat, but they use the C-trumpet a lot more. There's a lot more cross-pollination. Mm-hmm. The Americans, it's been a lot of different things. It was originally B-flats a lot, but then a lot because of Georges Majere, who was a legendary principal trumpet of the Boston Symphony in the early 1900s. He kind of, was one of the ones who introduced and popularized the sea trumpet, and also in using different keyed trumpets.
A long connection with Boston and the French, anyway.
Exactly. It's very much a French orchestra. And Adolf Herseth was a big... He listened to Georges Majere growing up. He studied in the New England Conservatory, and he also went to the sea trumpet, and he played sea trumpet in the 50s and that. There are still some American players that play B-flat. I use B-flat on the Pops concerts. I use B-flat on certain pieces that I think it just feels better on. Mm-hmm. Gershwin. I tend to use the B-flat on Gershwin.
I'm glad you do, because it bugs me to hear Gershwin, the Gershwin orchestral works being played on C-trumpet. It just doesn't sound right to me.
It doesn't have the right... I don't think it has the right... color. It doesn't have the right... you just don't lean into it the same way.
Right.
Other trumpets can go in higher pitch. There's the D trumpet, which again is pitched a whole step higher than the C. Again, a little bit shorter, a little bit brighter, a little bit lighter sound. Now, sometimes you would use a higher pitch trumpet because it makes a passage more playable. You can be more... You can be more consistent and accurate.
Yeah.
Its accuracy is one of the main things these days. Back in the days of everyone playing B-flat, some of those parts were a little dicey on B-flat.
Yeah.
And if you go back even earlier, when the old F trumpet was in use with a lot of things, which is even bigger than the B-flat, amazing sound, but dicey in the upper register.
Yeah, you get some passages that, because of where it lies in the overtone series of the fingering, gets very awkward.
Awkward, and the notes get so close together, it's easier to crack the notes.
And intonation, intonation problems on the D trumpet are they're legendary.
Exactly. And then we go all the way up to the piccolo, which most people know of from things like the theme to the Masterpiece Theater or Baroque literature. Very, very light, very bright kind of sound, useful for the Baroque literature, which tends to be very high, and it allows for a little bit more delicacy up there, and allows you to be a little bit more accurate.
Mm-hmm. But doesn't make it any easier to play high.
No, it doesn't. I wish picking up a piccolo meant I could play an octave higher, but it doesn't work that way, because your lip is still vibrating the same frequency. It's just the amplifier is different.
Right.
Your lip is still buzzing the same pitch.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, makes the finger. The notes are not quite as close together as on
exactly. The
B flat. Mm-hmm. Well, thank you very much for the time you've taken to talk today, and look forward to working with you again in this upcoming concert and for many years to come.
I certainly intend to. Let's put it that way. And yes, just make sure on the Mahler you duck every now and again.
Mark Baldwin, thank you very much. And everyone who's listening to this, have a great day.